Working on 2080 today, Senator Carson. Oh, we're doing that. I know you had a letter for...
Any special amendments that I'd like to propose at some time, I'm in no rush, so whenever you're...
Well, let's go to 701, Senate Bill, while we're on Senate bills.
Okay.
So, your very niece is not here. Where is your...
absence evidence of that, he's going to be defeated in every situation. Now, that's not what we feel is the proper interpretation.
Excuse me, Mr. President. If no evidence comes in, he wins. Right?
We don't think is the existing law, and that's okay. What we think it should be.
Okay, but no evidence at all. He has a disputable presumption, so that the insurance company or Safe brings in no evidence whatsoever. He's going to win. That's what it is.
If that is the existing law, it really is. You're getting right to the gut of the matter. That's all this amendment attempts to clarify.
Well, I don't think so. I respectfully disagree. In this case, I've just read the case, but the fire chief brought in no evidence other he relied totally on the presumption. Safe brought in two cardiologists that after thorough examination said it was unrelated. So on the one hand you have a statutory presumption favoring the plaintiff. On the other hand you have solid medical evidence disputing it.
Well, I'm not disagreeing with the result of Kluthoff. Don't get me wrong. I think that was a proper result on the facts of that case. I'm not disputing the facts. I'm disputing the interpretation and the applicability of the disputable presumption. We think that the verbiage in discussing disputable presumption does exactly the opposite of what you just said. If, in the absence of any medical evidence, the fireman wins, that's what we think should be. We don't think that is what Kluthoff is saying.
Granted, they use the word equal poise, which always throws me, but I presume that means that they're equal. According to Greenleaf.
That's the point. If they're equal, in the absence of no evidence, they're equal. Then it just says...
But can it be equal? If there's no evidence, the presumption prevails. Is there any... Do you really disagree with that? I can't get that out of that.
We do.
You agree with that. Let's suppose that there had been absolutely no evidence whatever in the Kluthoff case. Would not have the fire chief prevailed?
He would have prevailed, yes. And I think there's been a subsequent decision in the Norris case interpreting the Kluthoff case, and if I might, I'll just read it. We construed this statute in Kluthoff. We observed that the disputable presumptions are defined in ORS 41-360 and stated that if there is some opposing evidence, the trial effects may consider all evidence on both sides and come to a firm conclusion. If the evidence is equal poised, the trial effect must find that the defendant, because of the plaintiff, had not met his burden of proof. Now, that was a quote out of the Kluthoff case. They go on to say, a claimant then is only aided by the presumption when there is no significant evidence to dispute his claim. Once there is such evidence, the usual rules apply that a claimant must establish his claim by a preponderance of the evidence. Hamlin versus Continental Pacific.
If that is the law, you don't disagree with that, do you?
No.
Okay, well, can't we agree that that's...
I think that's the law.
What we want to do with this amendment is simply to codify that interpretation.
Well, it goes beyond that.
Well, if you strike the word conclusive, well, I read conclusive shouldn't be there.
To me, the way I read it, and maybe I'm misreading it,
the last meeting we...
We struck
conclusive and put substantial.
Senator, you could drop the word totally as an adjective. Just say on the basis of medical or an ad or other, because there is a point that Keith and I discussed that I think is very relevant.
Senator Carson, you stopped too quickly, so I'm sorry I interrupted you. Go ahead.
Well, that's all right. I'm not terribly injured by that.
Yeah, right.
There are certain fact situations, and Keith can add to this. In other words, you can defend the case without having medical evidence. You can defend it upon the facts, as Keith will indicate. For example, a dispatcher who does nothing but sit in an office as a firefighter, dispatching for 30 years, is out in his field burning 8 acres and is breathing smoke, and he falls over dead. On the facts of that case, without medical evidence, you could overcome the presumption. And so what Keith is saying, and I agree, is that if you add after the word medical on line 19, the phrase or other, you are allowing the carrier to come in with evidence other than simply medical evidence to dispute the presumption.
Well, I think it's proper that for medical, did you say?
Or other. Then read as far as I can see in page 19 of subsection 1 of this section must be on the basis of medical or other evidence.
Mr. Chairman, I move those amendments.
Okay. Senator Crowe moves those amendments. Are there any objections? Hearing none, it is so ordered.
Do you have an objection, sir?
Is the word substantial in the amendment?
It's not in
it's just medical or other evidence. And basis of medical or other evidence.
Does that bother you?
Yeah. Yeah, that's what I agree. I don't think that's
anything. Well, Mr. Chairman, let me ask this. The effect of the pen is mental law exactly the way we the three of us agree this morning that
it should be. Well, that's what bothers me. Is that, I'd like to have Mr. Darren comment on that because he has a good point. You can't ever be sure in this particular type of situation the next case is going to do the same thing. That's the point.
Well, it's true, but let me ask you collectively, by adding denial of a claim or a condition or whatever, must be on the basis of medical or other evidence that the cause of the condition or impairment is unrelated to the department's employment. Seems to me that that's just, we state it in the first hand, there's a presumption going your direction, then we restate it, what the effect is the reverse, and that is if you're going to overcome that presumption, you have to have evidence that it's unrelated.
Right.
Seems to me they follow, you haven't really said anything.
All that it says, in my opinion, is that in, as you said initially, Senator Carson, the absence of any evidence, the fireman wins. That's what this amendment will do in Congress.
Well, that's to me was the way it is anyway.
Well, that's what we're not unsure of. Very unsure of.
Mr. Chairman, I wonder if by taking out the disputable presumption for those workers who have an airtight case and nobody's going to dispute the presumption, if you're not making it a more extended court case by having this additional language. Now they, whether it's disputed or not, they must come and present the medical or other evidence.
No, not the claimant.
No.
The claimant can still rely on the. If there is no evidence at all produced, he's going to win.
We're leaving indisputably.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Okay. I'm sorry.
And this requires the defendant to come in with some evidence to overcome the presumption. And it wouldn't. If I understand what we've done, by removing conclusive, pull all the thorns out of it, and we just restated the other half of the proposition, that is, the claimant's going to win based on a presumption unless the defendant comes in with some evidence, and then it goes into the quote that you gave from the whatever, the Norris case or whatever it was.
Yeah, that was
Mr.
Clapper have an objection to this.
Right. I don't have any particular objection. It seems to me, though, that the law and Duhop and Norris make it very clear as to what a disputable presumption is, and we're just adding more words to the statute.
But it doesn't do any harm. As I said, it might change.
Harm,
it might change. So
we're creating equal boys.
Mr. Chairman, I move to the floor. Mr. Chairman, let's read it in distance.
Let's see. At first, it would read in. Would read the First Amendment would be down as I understand it, down on
just
line 19.
The whole thing as it would be, please.
Okay.
Section
sub 2. Okay. Any condition or impairment of health arising under paragraph B of subsection 1 of this section shall be disputably presumed to result from a fireman's employment. However, any such fireman must have taken a physical examination of while becoming a fireman or subsequently thereto, which failed to reveal any evidence of such condition or impairment of health which pre-existed his employment. Denial of a claim for any condition or impairment of health arising under paragraph D of subsection 1 of this section must be on the basis of medical or other evidence that cause of the condition or impairment is unrelated to the fireman's employment.
Senator Wires? Mr. Chairman?
Aye. Aye.
What would you like to have?
2080, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Hill has talked to me on 2080, and as a result of the material that I distributed, I received this morning from Mr. Holmes and Mr. Gilly. Mr. Hill wants to talk to them and have an opportunity to respond to the issues raised.
Well, would you work it out? I mean, if there's with them and Committee of One, and
I don't know that I can, but I think they're going to work it out and vice.
That we're attempting to address.
I propose to go.
I think I'll leave the people on because I have a vote for me. I may want to work one at a time for whatever consideration you want to give them. First of all, just by way of preliminary statement, I met with Mr. O'Leary, also the attorney for Spears,
Mr. Ayers,
and with Bernard, Dave Shannon, myself. We met for about 3+ hours yesterday. We met for another hour, and I left, and probably some more time after that. These are an attempt on my part to meet, insofar as I think possible and appropriate, the objections raised by Mr. O'Leary in his testimony before the committee. These are not presented as joint amendments on his behalf and on my behalf, and he reserves the right to oppose the bill, but I think he will advise you that he thinks these amendments are go a long way to the position that he represents. I wonder if he might want to make a general statement, and I'll go through the amendments.
So I would appreciate making a general statement. Let me pass out to, like Senator Wilner has copies of these, and pardon the quality of the copy. These are the amendments that we gave to Senator Wilner. I think Roger will come out and correct.
Yeah.
These are the ones that we gave Senator Wilmer for SB 50. I have here copies of the amendments with comments, which are, for the most part, substantively similar, where the provisions are parallel for HB 1088. As Senator mentioned, we did meet. While we don't see eye to eye on each provision, I feel that he has either specifically or substantively met the bulk of our objections, and his amendments will yield what honestly has to be termed a generally balanced piece of legislation, balancing the interests of consumers and legitimate business. I think our major reservation relates to the class action provisions. We realize that there are arguments in favor of class actions. I won't burden you with the dissertation in class actions as I did last time. In the SB 50 amendments, which are the Thermofax copies that we gave to Senator Wilner, we started with a suggestion that the class action provision be deleted, which is our basically unalterable position. However, we did submit along with that our suggestions of class action management and protection provisions, which are attached to the back of the first three pages of numbered amendments. These are
opinion of what class action should contain. Senator Wellner and Foundation worked quite hard and worked out some alternative suggestions, which they'll be suggesting to you, which do offer some reasonable protections. We would prefer to see some of the language, more of the language from our senator in there, but we think that they've done a generally honest and balanced job. Actually met the substance of many of our objections, with the exception of our basic premise in regard to class actions that we oppose. As he goes through the amendments, you'll see, compared to the comments I made last week, that he reaches substantively to the bulk of our amendments. It's a balanced bill. We also feel that the Attorney General's bill, HB 1088, with the amendments that we submitted to it, is a bill that we would support. It doesn't have the class action provision. It does have the creation of the Consumer Protection Division in that bill, which we favor that division. No further comments.
Now I'm supposed to go, because you understand this, I'm supposed to go through the amendments, explain them as we go along, and suggest that the simple thing might be just take 5 minutes, go through all of them, and then come back to them one at a time. And in 5 minutes, I kind of summarize the whole pattern. Or you refer to them just one at a time. And I said you have in front of you amendments in proper form that will accomplish each of these. All right, the first one I think is essentially not controversial. It just says that the district court, a small claims court, a justice court, may also be a court which these matters may be heard. This is particularly important in connection with the private lawsuits that might be filed under this bill. I don't know if that's controversial.
I think it's a good one.
All right, then, did you want to act on these, or what?
No, I don't think there's any point in acting on them separately, but some of these proposals of Mr. O'Leary's, if they're on a page, and you have any comment, make it while we're on that page, okay?
Surely. I will make comments with the amendments where appropriate. It won't be very many.
All right. You have one proposed on this page, but indicated earlier it's a minor one.
Yes. Right.
Okay.
All right. Now, the next thing on page 3, the next amendment you'll find is line 5. Mr. O'Leary suggests taking out the words unfair methods of competition and we've taken those words out. This makes it, I think rightly pointed out that this is not a bill to protect other businesses, it's a bill to protect consumers.
Any questions now?
No,
I'm happy.
Should I go on to that one? The next one on line 19, I think, again, Mr. O'Leary suggested clarifying language. I think it's clearer than if they are not, rather than listing the alternative. That, I think, is almost better style, really.
And if they are not,
it represents a good, the original new, if they are not, is kind of more all-inclusive than saying if they are deteriorated, altered, reconditioned, reclaimed, used or secondhand. I think that's a stylistic change.
You don't need the word new again? I presume it's redundant,
but
I
had to read it twice before I knew what you meant. The way it is.
Well,
I got it.
Representing your original or new if they are not new.
If they're not original or new, I suppose you'd have to say it, John.
If they're not original. It's redundant, but it's
not original or new, then. That's a style. All right. The next one, here again, I think this is another suggestion where line 30, where we had said, unless the advertisement discloses the limitation of quantity, and a suggestion was made just stopping after disclosing the limitation, in which case the language is more inclusive. And here I think Mr. O'Leary suggests something which makes it fairer.
question here, what other things besides quantity come into this?
It would generally be quantity, I think, that what with concepts of ingenuity that people fear in the marketplace, the person, you could have a disclosure of a false limitation of quantity, which arguably wouldn't violate J as written. I think it's such a broader standard.
Okay. All right. Then on page 4, the pacing, we get down to the first two matters of some substance. If you recall, the first, I think, major point that Mr. O'Leary made in connection with this list of deceptive practices was that he didn't want a businessman to be innocently committing a deceptive practice. And we have written the language in number 3, pacing, here, which says, it shall be a defense to an action brought under Section 3 of this Act that the felon neither had knowledge nor with the exercise of reasonable care would have known that he was engaging in acts prohibited by this section. This language is roughly parallel to the language in the existing Oregon law, which has been there since 1967. Let me talk about the other one because they relate. Also, Mr. O'Leary objected particularly to items P and Q. If you look at them on lines 11 through 14 of page 4, because they were, he felt more difficult for a businessman to easily determine what was lawful and what was unlawful. In other words, they're kind of catch-alls. Like P is engaging in any other conduct, which similarly creates a likelihood of confusion or misunderstanding. And Q is engaging in any act or practice which is unfair or deceptive to the consumer. So, attempting to meet his objection, we have put in the new number 4. Sub 4, no action shall be brought under subsection P and Q or subsection 1 of section 3 unless the Attorney General has first established a rule or regulation under section 5 of this Act declaring the practice to be unfair or deceptive to the consumer. Then I think we better cross-reference to the top of page 5 and consider that with this, where we had given the Attorney General power to make rules or regulations, technical. But the new language, in accordance with procedures of ORS Chapter 183. So essentially what that means, put together, is that the Attorney General may, if he wish, suggest rules or regulations defining P and Q. And they are subject to all the procedural safeguards of Chapter 183, which is hearing, notice, and the possibility of a court declaratory judgment if the result is illegal. So by adding 4 along with this language on the top of page 5, you make it specific what the P and Q is with a due process procedure for getting there. And yet you allow the Attorney General to define practices which otherwise would be weaved around the other language. I think that's what I want to say about those 3 in a package.
On this point, I'd just quickly say that we still object to the P and Q objection to the omnibus clause. However, the subsection 4 and interrelation to section 5.2 modifies the substance of our objection and reaches toward the substance of our objection on the omnibus clause and certainly mitigates our problem.
John, if you delete both those sections, how much are you weakening?
Can I yield to Dave on that, Mr. Chairman? Dave's the guy who has been forcing us when I had a person to say. I can give you some examples of situations where people are ingenious enough to get around this decision.
One of the questions that's come up, particularly in the field of franchising, which we do not now have any regulation on, that is the sale of a product where you make investment up to $5,000 or $10,000, is income expectation. We don't have anything about that. The guy says, hey, you make $11,000 in 5 days, talking about a future fact. It ought to have some kind of relationship to past action. I I'm befuddled how I'm going to catch that one under present act. And this kind of thing would give an opportunity. Now, the Federal Trade Commission has brought actions against companies doing this kind of thing under their general section, which is unfair and deceptive practice. And now we have rules, we have decisions on their part or proposed rules under their FTC suggesting that this is unfair and deceptive, that it's a misrepresentation as to income expectation. I would consider this as an example that might come under here where the Attorney General would hold a hearing on this, giving people notice, and then present the question as to what kind of restrictions there are in this field. And as I said, I don't think we can cover it right now.
Yes, I was wondering, I'm a little bit in the dark as to just exactly how much the Attorney General is going to be allowed to do. We're not giving him carte blanche to go ahead and write to, you know, substantive changes in this thing with this. He has to relate them all back to what we have already spelled out. Is that the protection there?
I would read as to number P. They would have to relate to the A through O, since it talked about similarly. I think number Q is broader, but number Q would still have to meet the test of being unfair or deceptive and be subject to, first of all, the hearing procedure, and second of all, the declaratory judgment procedure of a court attesting it.
The proposed legislation from the Federal Trade Commission has this section in it, and it's the kind of language that would relate, very closely back to your Federal Trade Commission's proceedings.
You might look at the section 5 sub 1 at the bottom of that page and on the top of the next page, suggesting FTC interpretations as being
a relevant guide.
Present Oregon law does not have. I'm sorry, did I miss one?
Yes.
Forgive me. Underneath the, I missed. I don't think it's controversial, but on page 4, line 24, adding the words or regulation.
Also, the deletion.
The deletion.
Yeah,
the
deletion. Right.
Where? I'm sorry. Oh, forgive me. Yes, I'm sorry. There again, I think that is a redundancy, and again, this is in line with there. It's a consumer bill, not a bill to protect competitors. Forgive me for that. I think the next one of substance is line 22, page 5. Our present law does not provide that the prosecuting attorney give any advance warning to the person that he is proceeding against at all. We had proposed in this bill advance notice of 7 days for service of investigative demands. And 7 days for notifying the person of the alleged deceptive trade practice and relief to be sought. And this situation. It's fair, for example, to a person who, a large company that may have only a branch office on the ground and may wish to communicate with the home office. So that's an additional protection that's not provided by present law. We had said 7. Prentice and his proposal said 30. We suggest 10. Are you happy?
It's a matter of preference and convenience as opposed to dire needs.
It was our feeling that 10 days, the question is how much time it takes for the branch office to notify the home office, and some of them are fairly bureaucratic, but it was our feeling that if they were told that Dave Shannon is, or equivalent is after them, within 10 days they could prepare their views on the matter, we thought.
John, let me answer David's question here. If you give notice that you're going to file a suit, and there is some place later in the bill here where you can take some action if you expect there's going to be...
Next paragraph. The notwithstanding provision.
Oh, all right.
All right, then the next one is on section 9 on page 6. Where now notice section 9 deals only with orders once the practice has been declared to be unlawful. In other words, here we're getting to the remedy after the adjudication has been made. And we suggest that the appointment of a receiver or the revocation of a license as a technique of restoring the money to persons who were victimized after the court made the finding. You notice, after the practice appeared to be unlawful. We agree with Prentice that the revocation of the license is too extreme a remedy, and we have limited the appointment of a receiver in those situations to the situations where there's an urgent need to move. And this is fairly similar to the normal circumstances in which a receiver is appointed under present law. And this, again, I hope meets the objection that he was concerned with.
I think it does.
Yeah. All right, then on section 11, now we get to the problem of class action. And let me emphasize that the tenets of O'Leary and his client's position is that they're opposed to class action. Without waiving or diminishing his opposition to class action, he has suggested to us some ways of making it more palatable if we insist on having class action. We have carefully gone over the language that he has proposed, and since his language a little longer. This is based primarily on a combination of Massachusetts and California class action statutes, which are existing law in other states. Now, let me just outline basically what we're talking about. His first concern, and a very major concern, that's expressed the other day, was that he had no real objection to the $200 as being minimum damages if one individual sued. And that's in section 11, paragraph 1, line 6. But he thought it would be grossly unfair if there was a class action. And the class prevailed, and the $200 minimum damages provided for the entire class. We accept that and have written in the words actual damages, you see, which appears on line 14. All right, then this long insert essentially defines a procedure. Now, the first part of the procedure is essentially giving advance warning to the company that's about to be sued, stating what the complaint is and giving the company 30 days to meet it. Think of this in terms of a situation where maybe a branch office of a company, a branch manager has done something he shouldn't have done. We use an example in our conversation, but maybe a bad bait and switch operation. And when it's brought to the attention of the home office, they say, that's wrong. We're firing the branch manager. That still doesn't provide remedies for the aggrieved consumers. But it's a good example of the kind of situation where a responsible company in that situation should have the opportunity of meeting the problem in a correct way before they're faced with a lawsuit. That's essentially what we're getting at in this 30 days warning to them, during which time they've got a right to take restitutionary action if they wish. All right, then also as part of that, and if their restitutionary action is offered and it's not accepted by the plaintiff, and if a lawsuit is filed and the plaintiff does not get any more than was tendered, the plaintiff cannot pyramid cost and attorney's fees. That's the protection.
Well, now, wait a minute. On that point, though, if we can get $200 for actual damages, whichever is greater.
In the first paragraph. The second paragraph is the class action paragraph.
That's the individual right. But in the class action, they can still get that, right?
No. Class action, only actual damages. If one person sues, he can get the $200 and they don't worry. That's not their concern. Their concern is the multiple plaintiff problem. All right, so that's the first thing that these...
Let me get a question on that. Couldn't you evade the class action thing and make it more profitable for, say you had 100 people here and each one sued separately, as long as they can get $200 plus their attorney's cost, the first guy's proved they can do it. Wouldn't they end up possibly costing the same thing as a class action, and actually they have to go through the motions, of course.
Don't we have some language that they support our attorney's fee language?
Yes, that would be...
on individual states, what is that?
The section 4.
I think part of the problem is being avoided by the fact that if someone went out in that type of situation, we'd have to recruit his client.
I can see it. It's an unscrupulous lawyer saying, "Oh boy, I've really got something. I've won this case, and now boy, there must be thousands more of the same thing."
Except if it gets in the newspaper, the report of the
first one.
Of the first one, then others who purchased.
Yeah, don't we have to turn the line on section 1?
Yes, we do.
And was that not
it's section 4. I don't see it posted in there. The attorney's fees are provided in section 7, the new amended section 7.
So we have covered.
And it says...
it's not pasted in here.
No, it's not.
For some reason...
I don't know what.
For some reason, we do not have a paste-in on section 7. And we...
Subsection 7 has said that.
Yes, but that can be struck.
Will you read the language, David, and tell them where it goes?
That's our error.
We do have some material that covers, but I'm not going to get to what you're getting at. Which is in your amendment.
In any action, this is section 7. And it would, in any action brought by a person under this section, the court may addition to the relief provided in this section award a reasonable attorney's fees and costs if the following conditions are met. One, notice is given to the alleged violator of this act 10 days prior to the commencement of the action of this section. Such notice shall contain the alleged violation, the amount of damages sustained, the demand for damages be paid or the transaction be rescinded. B, the defendant refused the plaintiff's demand or did not respond within 10 days to receipt of notice. C, that if the alleged violation of this act, if the alleged violator of this act tenders an offer prior to the commencement of this action and the person bringing the action refuses the offer, that the person bringing the action must be awarded greater damages than the offer tendered.
I think it's in front of you in the credit amendment. Now let me just describe what that Dave, what page is it on in the amendment?
Next to the last page
of the printed amendment. page.
We don't have
that.
No,
you have this.
No, we don't.
No, you each have one of my amendments. I thought you did.
Sure.
No,
doesn't look like yours.
Here, let's try these.
I don't
here it is. Here it is. This is page.
Oh, now I've got it.
There it is. Here, right. Page 5 of the printed amendments. For some reason, we don't have these pasted in. Let me just describe what these do. At the present time, Hector, in Oregon, starts back here.
Yeah.
At the present time in Oregon law, may I go ahead and show you?
Yeah, go ahead.
At the present time in Oregon law, there are two situations that come readily to mind where a plaintiff can get attorney's fees in addition to his actual damages. One is a suit for property damage in a tort case or damage case under $1,000. And the other is a suit on an insurance policy, suing your own insurance company. In both those situations, they have analogous provisions where you must make advance demand and be rejected.
And prosecution, if it's possible.
Then our attorney's fees proper. So this is actually this language is something that Dave and I dreamed up in our concern for members of the Retail Trade Bureau, which even Prentice didn't find. It's a good permission. And so does he.
Well, fine.
Well, I think that will get it.
Looks like you've taken care of it.
I think. But anyway, let me go back to the class thing. The first thing was the opportunity of doing right before the suit is filed. That covers all of number 3. All right, then number 4 deals with a preliminary hearing. Now, the conditions here are conditions that the court must find before the suit can go forward. In other words, before the defendant company is put to the burden of defending on the merits against all of the claim frauds. This is a preliminary hearing which establishes if it's appropriate for a class action to go forward. And so the court must find, if you look on the second page, if the class represented suit is more appropriate individual actions. The members of the class are Oregon residents or the alleged wrongful acts occurred in the state of Oregon. That's to make sure that somebody doesn't file suit in court in Linn County and on behalf of all residents of Alaska, Idaho, North Carolina, and Linn County. 3, questions of law or fact common to the class substantially similar and predominant over questions affecting individual members. That's again just a way of saying if it's a true class action. You know, we do have an identity of interest, really. Number 4, the class can be reasonably identified and limited so as not to make the class unmanageable nor damages indefinite. Prentice is rightfully worried about a crime that suit's been filed in California was one file on behalf of all citizens of the United States. Not quite.
All citizens of the state of California.
No, this would allow a court to rule out that kind of a... then 5, provisions for notice to the members of the class. And this is important because the members of the class are bound by it. You see, so they must have notice. Then at the next page, number C,
this is taking the language of the so-called defense of mistake, the same language we had previously, Section 3, and saying that the businessman can, if he proves it's a mistake, that he's got a defense. And the important part of C is that it allows him to establish that in a preliminary hearing before he has to go through the whole long hearing and the ultimate case. In other words, if he can establish with a bona fide error as it's set forth here, that's the end of it right there. And other things that's set forth here. And then 5 provides that the court retains control of the class. This is important because the charge is sometimes made that when class suits are filed, that the original class often is charged in minority stockholders, where the minority stockholders in the business are filing these kinds of suits and seek to get bought off in some of the benefit to him rather than benefit to the class as a whole. So once the suit is filed, the whole thing is under the control of the court, and the court can ensure equity. Now, this, well, Valley won't be heard on this, but this goes to the substance of his concerns about class action, remembering he's opposed to it,
right?
And is based largely on Massachusetts and California existing law. I think he may want to comment on that.
My comment comes down to, as indicated in our suggested amendments here, we are opposed to class actions for the reasons I set forth last week. The attachment includes the same theory of the numerous of the protections Senator has inserted here. Not all of them exactly the same language put forth. Theory is there, substance is there. Problem for season didn't word here and there, and all in all, they reach a number of the technical protection management questions that we raised, but we still feel that class actions are inappropriate, inefficient remedy in these types of acts. This is a technical comment. I would think that in your C, on 4C, which is on page 3, is that your preliminary hearing should go to the acceptability of the restitutionary cure tendered by the alleged violator prior to the suit, without getting into the merits necessarily. Now, this was, as they indicated, derived from Massachusetts and California, and I think it's back on page 1, year 3, is derived primarily from Massachusetts. I think California notice demand restitutionary cure opportunity section is clear, provides more definite standards, and would affect a more efficient recovery for consumers than does the Massachusetts style that's adapted by Mr. Shannon, Senator.
Let me ask you a question. I assume under this language that you're able to at least get some kind of testimony and evidence and so on for a defense.
It would appear that way.
What if the judge denies this and says, no, there's plenty of evidence here for our case? Can that be used in the trial that the judge has refused already based upon...
Do you have a copy of the California...
Would that prejudice the court at the trial?
Well, it looked to me like this is kind of a segregated issue is really what it is. Well, in other words, in a trial of a lawsuit, suppose, let me put it in other terms, The plaintiff filed a suit for personal injury. Claimed his leg was cut off wrongfully. And the insurance company replies, you released that claim when we paid you $4 for it. Often a court will say that that segregated issue of the validity of that release shall be tried first, before the whole trial is held on the question of the merits of whether he was entitled to recover from a sawn-off leg. And if that issue is tried first, and if the release is held to be invalid, then you go ahead with the remainder trial. Never had it. If the release is held to be valid, that's the end of it. My thought here is to allow the defendant to try at this preliminary hearing the segregated issue of bona fide mistake without subjecting to the entire trial. Now, if there are two ways of looking at this. One is that that is a complete trial on that issue, which would be binding later on. The other way is kind of the preliminary showing approach. I admit the first, but maybe David wants
to. If I may, the Massachusetts Act, I do know, does have a statement as to evidence that any offer of settlement cannot be admitted. And you could put a provision in like that. I would think the court. I would consider this like a demur, you know, just for the purposes of this settlement, we're admitting that the major thing is he's admitting that this was a deceptive act. Now let's see if we'll remedy it. But that's just like a demur. It's only for the purpose of that motion.
Then it would not be a surrogate trial.
No.
Why don't you write some language? Because that way we can get that right.
I don't have the copy of the California provision with me. What it does is you start out with your 30-day demand notice for restitutionary cure or for a remedy on behalf of yourself and the class. Proceeds to the next point is it instructs, in effect, the alleged violator to attempt to do certain things. Ascertain class members. Notify them that will take the steps necessary to effect restoration or restitution of any nature that will remedy them for the deceptive practice. At that point, if you comply with those things, and the court can in an action, it then puts it on the plaintiff. If he feels that you have not complied with it, he can go ahead and proceed with his lawsuit for damages. And there's a very important distinction here, tracing back a little bit, but no class action be maintained for damages, where, however, you can bring an action for injunctive relief alone. I'd also like to point out this is a class action bill that we opposed in California last year. At that point, they're in a substantially different form than it originated. At that point, there's a provision in there that any attempt to comply with the restitutionary, to make a restitutionary offer by the alleged violator is not an out-of-court admission. And it's not, and it is inadmissible in evidence as an offer to compromise under the California Evidence Code. Showing bona fide in connection with the bona fide defense section in the California Act. The plaintiff is then at the risk of, it must make the decision as to whether the restitutionary cure is proper or not. He can then file a suit or not file it depending upon his determination. If he is wrong and he files the suit, the fact that the alleged violator has performed an appropriate restitutionary cure in the eyes of the court in a defense, or would be in the nature of a defense since it would have cut off the right to apply that. As to the substance of California.
It seems to me that this has some analogy to when they're hearing in a criminal case, in which the defendant, you know, usually is off his rocker if he says anything. And that's what I'm saying here is, aren't you? If you put on any evidence in that preliminary hearing, is it going to be used against you in the trial?
I question.
Or what the determination of the judge was.
I tend to agree with you because I feel that the part in here about that the alleged violations were not intentional and result from bona fide error, notwithstanding the use of reasonable procedures adapted to avoid such error, it raises questions of fact relating to the case as opposed to the merit of the restitutionary offer.
Dave, do any objection to striking C at all? Entirely.
No, I don't have any objection. I would see this as a first step is that the company has made a settlement offer which has been rejected by the class plaintiffs. Then he comes into court at this preliminary hearing and would like to reassert that settlement offer primarily based on his belief that any act that did occur was unintentional on his part. And so he's trying to force the plaintiff class to accept the settlement partly based on they've already rejected it. They accepted in the first place, you'd never get to this stage. But because he's already given them notice. Now you're in court. And he's trying to say that was a reasonable settlement offer primarily because I had no knowledge as to what was going on. I don't see how he's injured because he's not making admissions.
Well,
I have no objection to striking C and R and just stating that that the defense that it just picking up the entire language from previously, it's saying it shall be a defense that the alleged violations were not intentional as only were prior.
Well, I think that when you have that prior language, it's the defense is there. The point here is to encourage either an intentional or non-intentional violator of the act to perform without going through the process of litigation, without going through the long drawn-out battle. So you have to have something at the other end, something that will encourage the defendant to make an offer and cause the plaintiffs to seriously consider it, other than the attorney's fees section. In the nature of what you have in C, but without going to the merits, this is why the California provision, when I was talking to Dave earlier, is I said that in this type of thing, we much prefer the California thing. This is one of the reasons, because it has that type of built-in mechanism in it that would offer greater protection. However, I would again reiterate that my comments are suggested as technical because we, again, are removed class of.
Dave, my suggestion, maybe we might go ahead and meanwhile, Dave can try and add language that does this. I think it's.
Would that be federal?
Sure.
Well, all right, I think you understand what we're doing on class action, and the next thing is. We've read you the provision of number 7 on attorney fees, which you have on the print on the amendments that are not pasted in.
Joe, we need a 6 in here sometimes, but I'm
going
to grab here.
6 is 3 should be crossed out, and 6 inserted. It's also part of the
on page 7, line
3 should
become
15.
So 6.
All right, then.